There is a quorum present. Representative Eakin, would you move the approval of January 28th?
Yes, Madam Chair, I move the minutes for January 28th.
Representative Eakin moves the minutes of January 28th. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are approved. Today, the Department of Agriculture and Health joint presentation on food safety. And I'm very, very happy to see you, and I'm very, very proud of Minnesota and with the peanut problem that we're having. So if you want to come forward and help us out.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. My name is Jean Danaher. I'm Deputy Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Health. And I want to thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee for inviting us here today to appear on this issue of foodborne illness. It is the mission of the Minnesota Department of Health to serve, maintain, and protect the health of all Minnesotans. Our charge is to protect the health of the population rather than the health of individuals. One of the ways that we do this is to collaborate with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture to identify foodborne illnesses and trace back the cause to its source. The staff that you will hear from today are exceptional in their ability to do this service, and our departments are known nationwide for their skill in this area. Thanks to you, members of the legislature, we were given the resources to conduct such work in the form of a world-class laboratory facility and highly trained professionals. These are truly extraordinary and dedicated individuals. And today we look forward to sharing with you Minnesota's successful methods in detection of foodborne illness.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Jim Borbom, Deputy Commissioner with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. Our objective today is really to highlight the partnership between our agency and the Minnesota Department of Health in dealing with a foodborne outbreak. And as you know, there's been a lot of issues in the news recently about foodborne illnesses, and we're happy to talk about the strength of the partnership with our agency and other agencies. And we'll begin the testimony this afternoon by just giving you a brief overview of the statutory responsibility of the two agencies. Following that, we'll go through three case studies that recently occurred, and the purpose of those case studies then would be to highlight the respective role and responsibility of our agencies in dealing with the foodborne outbreak. And I'm happy to talk about or introduce one of the staff members in our agency, Ben Miller, who will talk about the role of the Department of Agriculture. But before I do, I'll talk about our mission statement. The mission of the Minnesota Department of Agriculture first is to protect the integrity of our food supply. Secondly, protect the health of our environment. And number three is to promote a strong agricultural economy. So, Madam Chair, members, thank you again for the opportunity to be here. And I'd like to call on Ben Miller.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity on behalf of our Variant Food Inspection Division of the Department of Agriculture. Today I'm going to go through some of the work that we've done over the past year in responding to some of the foodborne illness and food safety events that probably all of you are familiar with in the news. And in doing so, we're going to touch on the close working relationship that we have with the Minnesota Department of Health and their foodborne illness investigation unit. And I think you'll see as we go through some of these case studies that close collaboration and how we work together to identify illness when illnesses do occur, how we identify them, and then how the product is traced back to the source of the problem and then taken out of commerce to protect the consumer. In doing so, I just want to give you a quick background on the Dairy and Food Inspection Division. We inspect dairy farms, processors, transport vehicles, food processing facilities, grocery stores, meat processing facilities, and feed mills throughout the state. So we have a wide variety of facilities that we inspect and regulate. and is doing so. I think you should have this handout as part of the materials that were given to you today. It's really, it's there to illustrate the farm-to-table continuum. This particular handout focuses on meat and poultry processing, but it really applies to most of the food items that we inspect and regulate in the state. And you can see that the Department of Agriculture has a wide purview all the way from the producer level to the retail level where it's finally sold to the consumer. And that's where our colleagues at the Department of Health come in when we're investigating things like foodborne illness outbreaks. What I'd like to do at this point is to provide some background, is to show a video of some of the inspection activities that our inspectors routinely do. It's about 10 minutes long, but I think it provides a very nice background on the field activities that go on day to day within our department that our inspectors work on. This one focuses primarily on food inspection. So you'll see the video, you'll see some of the types of facilities that we inspect and regulate, and I think that provides the foundation from which then when we do end up with events like melamine, like the salmonella trace back for jalapeno peppers and in this instance in peanut butter, we build off that infrastructure that's in place. So I will tee up the video here.
Americans eat from the safest food supply in the world. This doesn't happen by luck or accident. A lot of hard work goes into ensuring the food we eat is safe and wholesome. But whose job is it? Join us as we go behind the scenes of the Minnesota Department of Agriculture's Food Inspection Program. When the refrigerator and cupboards are bare, we head to the grocery store. But the story of food safety doesn't start or even end there. It's the job of the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, or MDA, to make sure you're eating or drinking a safe product. MDA is the enforcer of state laws and regulations related to food production, processing, and sales. MDA also conducts inspections for the Federal Food and Drug Administration using state authorities. It's MDA's Dairy and Food Inspection Division that oversees inspections from everything from dairy farms and food processing plants to grocery stores and convenience stores. Let's take a look at three facilities where your family's food comes from: a food processing plant, a bakery, and a grocery store.
My name is Andy Faber. I'm a food inspector with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. What I'm here for today is a routine inspection of a manufacturing facility. We manufacture ingredients for use in the food industry.
Food inspectors conduct an average of 7,500 inspections each year. From floor to ceiling, inspectors examine every part of the facility and manufacturing process to make sure the end result is a safe product.
We want to make sure that the product is handled in a safe fashion, that they're not introducing any adulterants or foreign matter into the product, that it's not coming from anywhere else, and that the facility is free of vermin, insects, or rodents, and that type of thing, and that there really aren't any microbial hazards here at this place.
Inspectors are often accompanied by a representative of the facility. During the inspection, they discuss issues that may develop.
We discuss the inspection as we're going on, and we discuss different ways in which they're cleaning or handling products or just some of the manufacturing that's going on as it is. In addition to protecting the public, it's also important to help protect the places I work for. I want to make sure we all have the same interests and goals in mind, and that I don't want them having any problems any more than they do.
Inspectors follow the manufacturing process through the plant, but backwards. They start with the most critical areas where the actual processing takes place. If some sort of food contamination were to happen, this would be the first place inspectors would look.
And what I'd be looking at this is just if you could feel some of the edges around the cut there.
From there, inspectors look at product handling before the processing. They end up at point of entry, where everything comes into the plant. No part of the plant is left unchecked.
You want to make sure from some of these more forgotten places are some of the places that can potentially have some of the problems that we'd be looking for.
But no inspection is the same. Each manufacturer, each store, offers a unique situation with a different set of challenges.
Hi, I'm Kristen Bigger with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. I'm a food inspector, and today we're inspecting Franklin Street Bakery. The bakeries, it ultimately will get cooked, but you want to, along the way, make sure you're not adding anything to the product that you don't intend to be in it. Usually flour will have things like flour beetles. Rodents are also attracted to bakeries sometimes, depending on the product. So those things you want to look for. But ultimately, handling of the product once it's cooked, and making sure that employee handling of the product throughout the process is not adding anything to the bread that wasn't intended to be in it. Serving hand washing.
Inspectors not only look at worker hygiene, they make sure proper safety measures are taken. Hairnets are worn and jewelry is not.
Coolers have a thermometer usually. And since this is a refrigerator, we like to see it below 40.
Armed with a thermometer, inspectors also make sure ingredients going into the final product are kept cool in order to minimize spoilage and unsafe bacteria. Temperature readings are taken and product date expiration dates are noted.
We can look at the egg date.
Inspection rules and regulations have changed over the years in an effort to ensure the safety of our food supply. And one key area that's become more important than ever is addressing food allergens.
So this product has nuts on it, and it's being stored underneath all the other products so that if a nut were to fall off, it wouldn't fall onto another product.
MDA staff also monitor and provide guidance on food labeling, making sure all potential allergens are declared right on the package. Again, from top to bottom, MDA's food inspectors are trying to ensure all food and beverages produced in Minnesota are the safest possible.
The inspection process just makes sure that the operators are doing what they're supposed to. So it's a very important process, but the most important process is having knowledgeable employees and knowledgeable operators.
Knowledge is key at the place where most of us come into contact with food, the grocery store.
I'm Catherine Freemeyer, a food inspector with the Dairy and Food Inspection Division of the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. Today we're inspecting a grocery store, and we are going through the deli, bakery, fresh meat, and general grocery areas.
Food inspectors look at their job in two ways, as enforcer of rules and regulations, and as educator.
How it says barley flour, it's a huge teaching opportunity to be able to help people understand the interaction between the rules that we're coming to enforce, and to know the reasoning behind them so that they have a better way to make their own decisions on a day-to-day basis when we're not here.
One of the most diverse areas of food inspection is the grocery store. Not only are there food storage issues, but some of the items we purchase at the store are made right on site.
We look for the things that are the most potentially hazardous, which would be a ready-to-eat, hot or cold-held food, and then working down through some of the room temperature stuff where it's still ready to eat, and then with some of the stuff that's going to be further processed or that's not potentially hazardous, like the general grocery areas where it's just dry storage holding issues.
Correct temperatures are critical to food safety.
Have any of these salads been out recently?
Inspectors make it a point to talk with employees to make sure they are aware of proper procedures and regulations.
Is this the sanitizer that you use, or do you use any cleaning in between?
We do clean them between, but I want them sanitized after they're behind.
After each area is thoroughly checked, it's time to turn to the report. Whether they're at a grocery store, bakery, or food processing plant, each inspector completes a written report outlining observations and any situations that need to be remedied.
We have two parts to the report. The first part is, it's kind of like a cover sheet. The top half is considered foodborne illness risk factors and public health interventions. These are all things that have been directly linked to various foodborne illness outbreaks. That would include employee hygiene such as hand washing, approved source of their foods, a lot of the temperature issues that we look for, whether it's cooling, cooking, hot holding, cold holding.
The bottom half of the report outlines good retail practices. While still important for running a food facility, these practices are a bit less critical. These issues include clean floors, appropriate plumbing, and food labeling. The second half of the report includes written comments and any issues that need to be taken care of to bring a facility into compliance.
What we're looking for is pretty much people who have lots of food handling.
The final component of any inspection involves a meeting between the inspector and members of the business management team. They go over the report and discuss any changes that could or need to be made. The Minnesota Department of Agriculture's food inspection program is key to food safety. The department works closely with processors and retailers to improve and maintain their procedures. It truly is a partnership.
Sometimes there's compromises, give and take between the two of us as far as what needs to be done, what should be done, what has to be done. But in reality, the whole thing, it's a partnership that helps us produce a better, safer product.
I view the inspection process very helpful. They really come in and look at what we're doing, offer suggestions for things that maybe we're not doing properly. They really come in and just look at what we're doing and make sure that we're doing a good job. It's important for us to do a good job, and they really just offer help.
The fact that I've worked in like five or six states, and Minnesota tends to be, I would say, more stricter, but they're just ahead of the game, I guess, and I've learned that. And I think they would do a good job as far as they come and present the problem to us, and then they help us educate us how to get rid of the problem.
That partnership also includes other government agencies. The Minnesota Department of Agriculture investigates reports of food contamination, working together with state and local health officials to determine the cause of outbreaks of foodborne illnesses. NDA employees work hard each day to ensure your family's food is safe to eat. But why is it important for the Minnesota Department of Agriculture to take on this duty?
When you buy your food at a grocery store, the typical consumer doesn't know exactly where it came from. They don't know all the people that were involved in making that product, and so it's important for somebody like the Department of Agriculture to be involved in that process and overseeing what's going on in the facilities to make sure that the product is a safe product for the consumer and it is what they think they're buying. I think we have a lot of ability to get to the bottom of an issue. We have the ability to do any trace back issues back to manufacturers that we may inspect. Or maybe just figuring out how the different areas are handling, whether it's through distribution.
With the authority to enforce state laws and regulations, the department is also able to provide something no one else can, a consistent inspection system across all of Minnesota. By unifying the process, the MDA avoids a patchwork of agencies trying to provide inspections and safeguards to the state's food supply. Overlap or possibility of gaps in the food safety system are minimized. This also results in efficient use of public resources. So at the end of the day, there's just one goal: to protect your food from farm to table. And it's all thanks to a group of dedicated employees from the Minnesota Department of Agriculture.
Thank you for taking the time to watch that. At this point, I would like to turn it over to Dr. Kurt Smith. He's going to discuss a little bit of background on the Foodborne Disease Surveillance Unit at the Minnesota Department of Health and the partnership that we have with that.
Representative, do you know?
So thank you, Madam Chair, and testifier. The issue in the news today prominently, of course, is the Salmonella poisoning. And I'm just wondering if you have any insight into how this happened in Georgia, and what provisions do we have in Minnesota to make sure that we don't have a Salmonella outbreak because of something here.
Madam Chair, Representative, it's an excellent question. The Georgia Department of Agriculture, I think, has been in the news recently. There was an inspection that happened at that facility earlier this fall that turned up a number of deficiencies, but those deficiencies didn't seem consistent with the FDA's investigation once they got into that plant. We do work very closely with the FDA district office here in Minnesota. We actually conduct contract inspections on behalf of the FDA. Our inspectors go out using their state authority to conduct these inspections. They focus mainly on facilities like that, manufacturing facilities. Because the FDA doesn't have the staff to get into those facilities on a timely basis that they would like to, that's why we have this contract in place. All of our staff are go through a very intensive training program, and those types of manufacturing facilities are typically inspected by our more senior staff. Those staff are also audited by the FDA as part of that contract that we have with them. So not being able to speak to the situation in Georgia, what I can tell you here is in Minnesota that because of that partnership that we have with the FDA and really given the level of training that our inspection staff have, and I think hopefully that was outlined a little bit in that video, that while something, you never know what's going on all the time, but we make every effort to get into all the facilities on a regular basis. Those facilities would be a high-risk facility and inspected once a year. And so if there are deficiencies noted during those inspections, there's follow-up with those facilities based on the findings, but our inspection staff do get out and follow up with those facilities as well. If violations would be noted, that would be worth this. If we found a facility that was, say, equivalent to the Georgia facility, definitely would be followed up there.
Representative Erdahl?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. Maybe I missed this, but just as a follow-up, how often are these plants inspected?
Sure. Madam Chair, Representative, the inspection frequency is broken out by risk factor, so each facility is depending on what they do, is the inspection frequency is determined by risk. We have high risk, medium risk, and low risk facilities. Any food manufacturing facility equivalent to the one in Georgia that would be manufacturing a product like that would be a high risk facility here in Minnesota and inspected annually. Medium risk is once every 18 months, and low risk is once every 24 months.
Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think there was a number, I was just asking Representative Drazkowski earlier, do we hear that inspectors do up to 7,500 inspections a year?
Madam Chair, Representative, that's correct. We have about 30 food inspectors. We have about 30 food inspectors, and between those 30 staff, they do get out and conduct about 7,500 inspections annually. We license and regulate on the food side of it probably close to 8,000 facilities. So.
Madam Chair, if I might follow up, I just want to make sure I'm doing my math correctly. About how many days a year does a food inspector work?
Mr. Miller?
Madam Chair, Representative, they work the regular 5 days a week. They're usually out in the field, typically 5 days a week, the end of their work week, usually Friday afternoon. They're following up with paperwork, but they're only out in the field conducting inspections every Monday through Friday. 52 weeks a year.
So, Madam Chair, if I may follow up, my math would have them doing about 30 inspections a day. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative, that would be, and I apologize, I don't know exactly how it was stated in the DVD, that may have also referred to all of our program area inspections, which would include dairy facilities and feed farms, or feed facilities as well as meat facilities. So, yes,
Madam Chair, I'll just follow up with a final question, and I'd like to hear more. Maybe, maybe we can hear about. You can respond by letter and let us know. But I was just dividing 7,500 by 250 working days, and coming up with 30. And that's what I was checking with my colleagues here. Is the department then overstaffed, understaffed, appropriately staffed to do the food inspections?
Mr. Miller,
Madam Chair, Representative, in the food inspection area, I think the inspection frequency is what dictates how often the staff get out. They try to meet their goals for, if they need to be at a facility within a year, say on a yearly inspection for a high-risk facility. Every effort is made to go out and maintain that frequency. Mm-hmm. And I think by and large that's the case. I can certainly get those numbers for you and provide that to you if you're interested in terms of how many facilities may be behind that schedule. If that's something you'd like, we can pull that together.
That'd be very helpful. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay.
Representative Falk.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I just want to clear up what Representative Morrow was questioning. When you say 7,500 inspections, is that for each inspector or for all 30 put together?
Madam Chair, Representative, that would be for all 30 staff or for
all
the division, depending.
So each inspector is doing one or one and a half per day, not 30 per day.
Correct. Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
So
we got it now.
Yeah. Somebody's math is a little slow. I do have another question, if I may, Madam Chair. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is, if we have a manufacturing plant and they're manufacturing powdered milk or whatever they are they required to keep samples of each batch or anything that they keep for further reference if there's a problem with that product?
Madam Chair, Representative. That's dictated by manufacturing practices that are dictated by the Good Manufacturing Practices Part 110 of 21 CFR, which is a federal document. It's not specifically laid out what needs to be done. Now, good manufacturing practices would suggest that that's a good practice to keep a library of samples that you can then go back to and reference in terms of your production dates. It's not. It's something that some facilities do. It's something that others don't.
Representative Paul.
If I can follow up, and thank you, Madam Chair. My understanding is in the feed industry, they do take a sample of every load of feed that goes out. It makes sense to me that if they're required to do that for feed for a bunch of cows or hogs, that why aren't we doing that in every situation for food that eventually is consumed by humans?
Madam Chair, Representative, excellent observation in those feed. The feed regulations are separate, obviously, it's written from the food, but it's an excellent observation.
Representative Doty.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That roughly 8,000 facilities that you mentioned, does that represent absolutely every facility that we think needs to be inspected?
Madam Chair, Representative. I think we license all of the facilities based on the practices. When somebody wants to begin a new business, they come to us and ask us, how should I be licensed? Here's what I want to do. And we have compliance staff that walks them through that process and then they have to meet a certain requirements, have a pre-inspection, if you will, to be licensed and operate. Certainly the challenge exists to find facilities that may fall without, that may be operating that aren't properly licensed within the state, and that's something that our inspection staff look for when they're out doing the routine inspection, or that we react to it, or if we have a report of that at the department. Does that answer your question?
It butts right up against my question, but and I realize maybe it's not a yes-no question, but I guess what I'm getting at is are there uninspected establishments that should be inspected?
Madam Chair, Representative, no, not that we're aware of.
And Madam Chair, one more question.
Representative Doty.
Does your department do all of the inspections of this type, or do you contract out for other inspectors in some places, or talk about that a little?
Sure.
Mr. Miller.
Thank you. We do have delegation agreements with several of the larger counties and municipalities, and I can provide a list of those delegation agreements to you if you'd like, or the agencies that we delegate our authority to. That's done in a retail setting, but not for manufacturing or wholesale distributing. So that would mainly be grocery stores, convenience stores type facilities, not food processing facilities.
And a follow-up, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Doty.
Who determines whether you farm it out or do it yourself? Is that requested by these local government entities that someone else, and do they choose who inspects them?
Madam Chair, Representative, we would have to... that's spelled out in statute, I believe, and I don't have all of the background on that. I could certainly provide that for you, but I believe it was laid out roughly 10 years ago who could qualify for that delegation agreement or not. And so I don't believe that it provides for any new entities to come online to do that kind of work. It was essentially staff, or it was agencies that had that capacity at the time that legislation was passed.
Representative
Doty. So if my county would rather have someone else other than you inspect facilities in my county, can they just make that determination? Or who actually decides within any government level. Who actually decides who gets to do the inspecting?
Mr. Miller.
Representative, thank you. I am not an expert in that area. I'd have to refer you to somebody that understood that process better than I do. So I apologize, I can't answer that question.
I hope we can find someone who can answer that question and get back to us on that.
Sure.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I think I might be able to help just a little bit, and certainly I'd be happy to follow up with Representative Doty. My name is Quinty. I'm the Policy Director at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, and there is a statutory language which defines how the delegation agreements work for the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, and there were changes to that statute that were made a number of years ago, and some counties were grandfathered in, and then some counties continue to have those agreements. And there are a number of qualifications as far as the type of sanitarian that has to be on staff and things like that for the inspectors. So we do work with the counties if they want to have a delegation agreement. I know that there have been some issues last year with counties that were interested in sub-delegating further than that, and that's not something that we are encouraging to go any further.
Thank you. Representative Joseph.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Miller, thank you for your presentation, and thank you for all you do at MDA. I would just point out that your video is correct. We do have the safest food supply, actually, in the history of the world. And we've got a very good food inspection system here in Minnesota. I think we all need to be very proud of. My question to you is, as we look back in decades and maybe even centuries, we've seen the technology and the methodology, if you will, come to one that tries to anticipate earlier on in the process, and this is your science that you folks work with a lot. What type of things are you doing to push that time even further out, to be further out in being able to even anticipate some of these things? As we look at least in my recollection, we haven't had a lot of really, or maybe really any catastrophes in Minnesota, and we have had very little in the past decades of problems that have even gotten out of the box, if you will. But what have you? What are you doing to even push that earlier in the process so that you can even do a better job?
Mr. Miller.
Thank you. We have some examples, I think, that kind of illustrate the point of that question coming up in our partnership work with the Minnesota Department of Health, both on the disease detection side, but then certainly in our laboratory as well, some of the new laboratory methods that have become available probably in the last 10 to 15 years have certainly given us more power in terms of detecting organisms when they're in products and decreasing the time to detection as well in terms of being able to identify when a product may be contaminated and being able to take appropriate regulatory action when that's the case. And my colleagues here at Health will demonstrate some of the mechanisms that they use, and I think the case studies that we have, the melamine, the jalapeno pepper salmonella traceback of last summer, as well as the peanut butter outbreak that's ongoing, start to illustrate some of those points in terms of how things may be, how the timing may be faster here in Minnesota compared to other parts of the country or maybe other parts of the world. Certainly it's a challenge when we're dealing with products that are produced outside of the borders of the country as well as the state sometimes in terms of dealing with food safety problems.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to follow up quickly, that raises another question. What are some of those challenges that you come up with within looking at items that come from other countries? Can you maybe outline what those are just quickly? I'm sorry for prolonging here.
I think 3 years ago, if anybody had mentioned that melamine would be an issue in pet food or human food, that nobody would know what we were talking about sitting here on the table. So some of it the difficulty can begin anticipating what those issues are. Certainly when you look at the way ingredients are manufactured worldwide and distributed, and all of the products that they end up with, probably illustrated very well by the salmonella and peanut butter outbreak that we're dealing with right now. Just before I came over, I checked the recall list on the FDA's website, and we had over 800 distinct products that had been recalled because they'd been either they were peanut butter, they were manufactured with peanut butter or peanut paste from that facility. So when you look at the distribution of ingredients and how our food is produced, one of the biggest challenges is simply understanding where those key ingredients come from. In the case of dairy protein powder that's contaminated with melamine or peanut paste that's used to manufacture Cliff Bars or something along those lines, the challenge is knowing where all that product goes, even if you have identified the source of contamination, determining where it impacts the consumer in the marketplace. And that's going to be a challenge if it's domestic or internationally produced product.
Representative,
thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Miller, I think the vigorous round of questioning you've had here, I answered almost all the questions already. I have a couple of them. When you said the inspections of high level, medium level, and low level facilities take place on an annual or a 1.5-year or 2-year basis, just without specific numbers, but roughly, what's the percentage or the fractional amount that are high level facilities versus low level facilities?
Sure.
Mr. Miller.
Representative. I can get those numbers for you. I don't have them right off of the top of my head. Either the high-risk facilities are going to be the ones where food manufacturers, they're probably a fewer number in the state. Low-risk would be something where it's all prepackaged food. So we may have a large number of those accounts, but you're talking about candy bars and chips and things like that.
Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One other question. I think Representative Drazkowski was getting on to this. Country of origin labeling. Are your inspectors charged with verifying country of origin, that the proper labeling is on the components either coming into a facility or leaving a facility?
Madam Chair, Representative. As I understand it, the country of origin labeling is not designed for food traceability. It's designed, was put in place for other reasons, and I don't have the background or expertise to speak to what those other reasons are. It may be, if that system were modified, that it might be more useful in that area, but currently that's not of great value in tracing where ultimately a final manufactured food product may come from. So, thank you.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Miller, just quickly, another question came up over on this side of the table. With all of, we have a lot of schools in Sherman, Minnesota, nursing homes that have purchased the peanut butter or derivatives from this company in Georgia. How are they alerted? Are they all inspected? Do they get a letter saying check, phone calls? What is the procedure in something like this?
Madam Chair, Representative, in an instance like this, when you're talking about nursing homes and schools, school lunchrooms and things like that, that's again where we kind of partner with our colleagues at Health because they regulate those types of facilities. There are multiple mechanisms that are in place used to alert those types of facilities: automatic calling systems, letters, follow-up phone calls. Of which Health or the Department of Health is used as has our department as well to inform, basically because of the scope and breadth of the recalled product. In this instance, we contacted literally all of our wholesale food handlers just to let them know, ask them, make them aware of the issue if they hadn't been, and then followed up with some of the larger distributors in the state. Our inspection staff are out this week, today, and for the next probably 3 weeks conducting what we call effectiveness checks in retail settings as well as in distribution settings to look for the product, any of those 800 and some products that are on the store shelves, to work with the retailers, to work with the food distributors to make sure that they're aware that really all of these products are recalled. And that list keeps growing, from the time the end of the day on Friday until this morning. I think another quite a few products added to that list. And that's going to be the ongoing challenge here, is informing and making sure that all those identified products are removed from sale and no longer available to the consumer.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just real quickly then. So would a school or could a school conceivably then get a list of 800 products?
Madam Chair, Representative, in this instance, because the schools were able to identify the product was distributed through, you know, the USDA school lunch program, they were aware of where those products were distributed to. So in an instance like that, it makes it easier. We were working with the Department of Education to make sure that information got out and that any product that was still in school lunchrooms is obviously discarded. So in that instance, because there wasn't a lot of product involved, that was actually fairly straightforward.
Any other questions to Mr. Miller?
I have a comment.
Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, in the United States, we have the safest, most nutritious, and abundant at the lowest price food source of anywhere else in the world. Again, the safest, most nutritious, and abundant at the lowest cost of anywhere else in the world. And nothing is apt to squash the future of any one segment of agriculture faster than the perception that the consumer is being sold an unsafe product. And nothing's apt to heighten that fear faster than the perception that the government is poised to do anything about it. So what I'm saying as a producer, I thank you for the job that you're doing, and I ask you to continue doing a good job, because the consumer is counting on you, the retailer is counting on you, the processor is counting on you, and us producers are counting on you as well. So thank you for the job that you've been doing.
Thank you, Mr. Miller. You did a great job.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Besser, and I'm the manager of the clinical laboratory at the Minnesota Department of Health. Dr. Kirk Smith and I are going to be representing the Department of Health in the discussion this afternoon. And this is our new laboratory, agriculture and health building that was so kindly financed by the legislature a number of years ago. And we're going to be talking a bit about that cooperative agreement arrangement we have. But first I'm going to talk a bit about our program. This diagram represents the farm-to-fork continuum. And Mr. Miller indicated, there's a number of steps along the way that we think that we can and should do to make sure that we have a safe food supply. Mr. Miller very nicely described several aspects of that safety program. But in spite of our very best efforts, about 78 million people per year get ill with a foodborne and diarrheal disease, and all of those are potentially preventable. And so our job at the Minnesota Department of Health is to gather information about those illnesses and use that information to help prevent further disease. And there's two ways in which we can affect that. Number one, we can work with our colleagues at the Department of Agriculture to limit ongoing transmission, and that's often through recalls and other mechanisms. So once we learn about a few cases of disease, we hopefully can prevent some more or many more people from becoming ill from the same sort. But I think that perhaps even a more compelling reason for our work is to fix some of the underlying problems that caused the outbreaks to begin with. And I think this is very much like in aviation safety. You know, we want to have trained pilots. We want to have all types of safety measures. But, you know, if there's ever a crash, we sure as heck want to know what caused that so it won't happen again. And every case of foodborne disease can be considered a failure somewhere in our system. And so our goal is to help identify those failures so that we can work with our colleagues and other agencies to mediate that situation. And so foodborne disease surveillance has been, I think, an extremely effective program over the last many years. These are just a few of the headlines, the outbreaks that have been detected through our surveillance system, not just in Minnesota, but our national foodborne disease surveillance system. And many or most of these have led to remediation efforts and refinement of the processes, given valuable feedback to producers so that they know that they have a problem and they can correct it. And these are, of course, two of the case studies that we're talking about today were, in fact, detected through gathering information about individuals who were ill. This is a timeline of the various places in the process that one could detect a problem in our food or water supplies. And this really can be separated into foodborne disease surveillance and the food monitoring programs in terms of laboratory testing that we've been talking about. And there's a number of programs in both areas that try to pick up signals from this process. And we're going to be focusing on the pathogen-specific surveillance, which is detected after people have become ill, so almost inherently not as rapid a process as primary prevention, but I hope to convince you that it's very important nevertheless. This is a schematic of the overall foodborne disease surveillance system, and it really starts in the lower left-hand corner over here with ill patients who may contact the health department directly with a complaint about their illness. They've eaten at a restaurant, or they've noticed a cluster of individuals ill, or they may go to their physician who orders a test. That specimens are sent to the local hospital or clinical laboratory. The local clinical laboratory sends what are called isolates to the Minnesota Department of Health, Public Health Laboratory. And the our epidemiology division, which Kirk represents, contacts these individuals, obtains case reports, interviews the individuals to find out their exposures, and we then work with our colleagues at the Department of Agriculture and federal colleagues to detect and investigate outbreaks. This is the state reporting rule lists a number of conditions that reporting to the health department is required under state rule. There's a rather lengthy list of these, of which a few are represented here. The items in red also require that isolates or other material be sent to the Minnesota Department of Health Public Health Laboratory for further characterization. This diagram shows the incidence of some of the major foodborne diseases that we track. And as an example, you can look at Salmonella, and we have annually about 700 cases of salmonellosis per year. And this really represents about, for every case of the disease that is reported to us, there's approximately 38 cases out there that isn't reported to us. And so the cases that are represented give us an opportunity to find out where foodborne disease is occurring and make sufficient recommendations. One of the big boons to our field is called PulseNet, and a number of years ago, the Centers for Disease Control started a nationwide disease tracking system where DNA fingerprints, essentially, of these foodborne pathogens that are received from ill patients at the Minnesota Department of Health, are DNA fingerprints are obtained and compared with each other and compared to fingerprints that are being found in multiple different states. And we use a central database at the Centers for Disease Control. And this is how we know often if when you hear about these outbreaks, whether cases are occurring in our state, whether it matches cases that are being seen in other states. And this certainly came into play in the infectious disease case studies that we're going to be presenting a little later. All 50 states now have, Minnesota was really the first, but all 50 states now have PulseNet laboratories, and this has vastly enhanced our ability to detect these outbreaks so that we can do something about them. And if you're wondering why there are so many outbreaks in these last 10 years, we don't remember so many in the past. It's partially because of PulseNet and partially because of improved epidemiologic methods that allow this enhanced detection of outbreaks. I've been keeping a list of some of the outbreaks that have been detected through PulseNet, and this is a list of outbreaks where greater than 750,000 pounds of product has been recalled And by my reckoning, we're up to 550 million pounds of food from this system. And so I believe it's an extremely effective way of detecting and remediating problems in our food and water supply. I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Kirk Smith.
Thanks, John. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kirk Smith, and I'm the supervisor of the Foodborne Diseases Epidemiology Group at the Minnesota Department of Health, and I'd like to pick up where Dr. Besser has left off. And the first graph shows the number of foodborne outbreaks that we've been able to detect and confirm over the years, and you can see for a long time we would have 40 to 45 confirmed foodborne outbreaks per year, but in the last few years that number has been increasing markedly, anywhere from 50 to 80 foodborne outbreaks per year. And I would like to talk just a little bit about how we do our surveillance and how we try to detect outbreaks. As John mentioned, when somebody goes to the doctor and they find a salmonella or an E. coli 157, so that laboratory has to send the isolate of that bacteria to Dr. Besser's laboratory, where they do the DNA fingerprinting on it real time. And then what we do in epidemiology is to interview everybody who has had a salmonella or E. coli 157 infection. And what we do, we compare the interviews then for the cases that have the same DNA fingerprint type. And that allows outbreak detection to occur a lot more often, a lot more quickly, and with fewer cases overall. And we do have a model program for the country, and part of the reason for that is we investigate all the cases centrally from our state office. And in most other states, it's the county health departments that are doing these interviews. They're using different interview forms, and they have varying levels of experience, and then that information has to flow up to the state, and they have to try to put it all together, whereas here in Minnesota, we're able to do this all from the central office, and it's what we do every day, and so we've gained a lot of experience in doing that. And we also do an interview that's very detailed. It's hard to remember what you ate 2 or 3 weeks ago, but we try to do a 25 to 30 minute interview, and with our experienced interviewers have pretty good success at having people tell us what they ate. And one of the resources, you may have seen this in the paper, we kind of say this a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but this team diarrhea refers to this resource, this great resource that we have. We have graduate students from the University of Minnesota School of Public Health who are getting their Master's of Public Health degrees, and we hire usually about 8 of them at any one time, and they'll work for us, and we train them, and they're the ones that are doing many of these interviews. We're interviewing several thousand people a year, and so this is a great resource for getting the information that we need through these interviews. And it's not as fancy as it looks, but basically we just use common sense. We're interviewing people right away, so when we have 2 cases that have the same DNA fingerprint, we know that we might have a common source outbreak. And so we'll interview those with our standard questionnaire, and if they say something that's interesting that's not necessarily on the standard questionnaire, we will ask that additional question for the subsequent cases. And likewise, going backwards, if the third or fourth cases say something very interesting to us, we'll go back and interview the first 2 cases. And it's kind of this iterative approach that allows us to kind of focus in on what an outbreak vehicle might be with relatively few cases. And I just let me go through just a couple of quick examples. These aren't the actual case studies, but just to illustrate that for many years we've had a great working relationship with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, and it seems like almost every year we'll have at least 1 or 2 bigger high-profile outbreaks that we'll collaborate on for the benefit of the Minnesotans and really everybody in the United States. And this was one in 2003 with only 4 E. coli 157H7 cases. We traced it back to these frozen vacuum-packed steaks that were sold by traveling salesmen. And it turns out they were needle tenderized, which basically took the surface E. coli contamination and drove it down into the middle of the steak. And so if you didn't cook your steak, well done. you could get E. coli 0157, and so this was great information for the federal officials in knowing that this technology was maybe not as benign as they had thought when they first approved it. In 2005, we identified an outbreak due to the dual classic romaine lettuce, and in this outbreak investigation, the Minnesota Department of Agriculture was the first of anybody to ever find E. coli 0157 in a leafy green during an outbreak investigation. And then in 2006, we identified an outbreak due to shredded lettuce that were sold at Taco John's outlets in southern Minnesota and in Iowa. And in that case, Mr. Miller and his colleagues traced it back to the farm in California, where they identified the mechanism of contamination, which ultimately was a dairy manure lagoon. And so when we saw these outbreaks, it really really drives national food safety policy, and these two outbreaks were a big part of the reforms that were ultimately conducted in the leafy green industry in California. And in 2007, an E. coli 0157 outbreak due to these ground beef patties, and this just shows every orange or red square is a case of E. coli 0157-87, and this shows that just 3 days after we got that second cluster of three cases, we're able to identify that these ground beef patties were the vehicle and get the word out to people. And we ultimately had 10 or 11 cases, and four were very seriously ill. And I think our timely investigation of this one, really, we were able to save lives, I think, because a lot of people had this ground beef left in their freezers, and the Department of Agriculture did isolate the E. coli 0157 from the hamburger patties. And so that's very quickly, our Minnesota Department of Health field. I know we're ready to launch into the case study.
Are there any questions? Representative Zaskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Smith and Mr. Betzer. The chart that you had that looked at the foodborne illnesses, the report, how would you characterize, or what would you characterize? I think you may have answered the question in your presentation. The detection methods have increased. Is that the main variable that really has provided for that almost linear increase?
Madam Chair, Representative, I don't think it's simply that, because we have basically had the same type of surveillance and outbreak detection in Minnesota for many years, and so I do think that at least some of that increase is real. Part of it could be better reporting and lots of foodborne outbreaks in the media all the time, stimulating other people to report their illnesses, but I do think some of the increase is actually real.
Representative Morrow?
Well, Representative Beth Kelsey, yes.
Representative Brody?
Thank you, Madam Chair. If we trace an outbreak back to the source, and theoretically that source would turn out to be Minnesota someplace, what do we do then to go back to the inspection? How thoroughly do we look at where we failed?
Madam Chair, Representative, that's probably a better question for the regulatory agencies, like our environmental health people at the Minnesota Department of Health or the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. But I do happen to know that they... I think probably more so than any other state, they do try to get back to the roots of the problem and find out why it happened and try to prevent it from happening again.
Madam Chair, follow up.
Representative Doty.
Would you guys hand it over to them then and say, here, track this down? I mean, who is responsible for making sure that does happen?
Madam Chair, Representative, it is the regulatory agencies that are responsible for that, but that's why we feel that it's so important to work together as a team to, when we can find out where an outbreak occurred and what food it was, that the agency that's responsible for regulating whoever made that food is really who needs to go and make sure it doesn't happen again.
Thank you.
Representative Eakin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess I was had a question along the same lines of what Representative Doty was asking, and felt maybe it is better for the regulatory folks to deal with it. But I was wondering, I thought it was good you were saying that you focus on the prevention. So you see every detection of an outbreak as a failure and the need to correct that and make sure it doesn't happen again. I don't know if it was found what the cause, as far as the peanut butter outbreak, what could be done to prevent that from happening again, and if anything's being done in that regard, and how often you do find out what the cause was, not just where it occurred and, you know, what product was causing it, but what led to this product to be contaminated with the salmonella or whatever.
Madam Chair, Representative, so is your question how often do these investigations lead to a successful result? Is that your question?
Right, that's the second part of it. Then I was asking specifically in regard to the peanut butter if anything's being done there.
Madam Chair, Representative, I'm not certain that I think the question is actually for health. How often do the investigations lead to a successful consequence? And I've seen data, national data, that about 10% of the investigations. I think we probably have a much higher percentage. Kirk, would you have any idea?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative, I think maybe the better way to put it is in a minority of instances in which we think an outbreak might be going on, we actually find the culprit. A lot of people don't realize that, but that certainly the more cases you have, the more likely you are to solve the outbreak. And like John said, I do think that we have a much higher success rate in Minnesota than other places, but I couldn't give you a percentage. Ben, I think they ever want to know your opinion on why the peanut butter outbreak happened.
Madam Chair, Representative. Maybe some of this will probably be illustrated as we go through some of these case studies. Now it's going to propose trimming off the melamine. If there are questions specific to melamine in our investigation, that they can certainly be directed to me after the hearing. Happy to answer any of those questions. To speak broadly, Dr. Smith mentioned, in many instances we don't have the benefit of knowing ultimately what the cause was. In the peanut butter example, FDA had findings, which you can actually go out on the internet and find their summary finding document from their investigation in the Georgia peanut butter manufacturing facility. It appeared there were a number of deficiencies in there that could have contributed ultimately to contamination of that product on an ongoing basis, and that would be supported by some of the laboratory or some of the testing that our laboratory has done as well in terms of finding not only the outbreak strain of salmonella but another strain of salmonella and product produced in that facility as well. And if we have a chance, we can touch on some of those findings as we go through those case studies and focus on the salmonella in the jalapenos as well as in the peanut butter.
Representative Mansky.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The question I have, probably going back to the foodborne illness from the point of origin in the processing of line. Do our storage and handling requirements, minimize the growth? Bacterial culture will, generally compound and grow over time. Do our handling procedures minimize that growth and prevent even larger outbreaks?
Madam Chair, Representative, certainly if it adhered to good manufacturing practices, temperature control, proper sanitation, things like that are designed to prevent the type of situations like I think we've seen associated with this peanut butter outbreak. Certainly, if a firm is practicing good manufacturing practices, that those risks should be largely mitigated.
Okay. Representative Manson.
The follow-up question then would be on irradiation of food, and do we see that as a potential in safeguarding our food supply even more if we were to irradiate some of these susceptible products to foodborne illnesses?
Mr. Miller.
Madam Chair, Representative. Without it, and I apologize, I'm not an expert in food irradiation, but certainly some food items would lend themselves to irradiation, and some don't. It's dependent on the product, but that would certainly limit the risk of microbial contamination in some product where that method would be appropriate.
Representative Mara.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You can see this is obviously a topic area of great interest. And I share Representative Hamilton's praise of the food and the food inspection industry. We were actually having a bipartisan conversation here, so you've helped us build bridges. One question that came up was, I know that I was ill a few weeks ago, and my mother was convinced it's salmonella. So what about, I think Representative Chemeski used, the right term, false reporting. People think they're convinced they've got food poisoning. How does that factor into either your calculations of the incidence rate, and do we see a good deal of false reporting? No, you really don't have salmonella, that type of thing.
Madam Chair,
what's the trend been? I've been asked to throw in.
Right, Madam Chair, Representative. That's a great point. There is, it's estimated that there are probably 1.4 diarrheal illnesses per person per year in Minnesota. So we may see 6 million illnesses in Minnesota. And, you know, there are scores of things that can cause that, some more common than others. And really there are things like something we call norovirus or viral gastroenteritis. It's this is the peak time of the year. And, you know, for every salmonella case that we're going to see, we'll probably see 100 norovirus cases. And so we have been getting a lot of calls like that. People who probably have norovirus are calling in because they consumed peanut butter. But that's our kind of our job, is to try to sift through all that sort of information. And and really it's the ones that have the peanut butter products that are on the recalled list that we know were made at that plant, you know, are the ones that we'll try to follow up with. But that's an excellent question. The rate of norovirus at this time in Minnesota is very high.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to follow up with that and in our combined question here, what has the trend been for some of the false reporting as you've looked at it? I think some of us would ascertain that maybe that trend has been an increase. Is that what you found?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative, so are you asking if kind of this increased media and increased reporting of people calling in, if that's led to maybe the increased detection of foodborne disease outbreaks? I do think that's probably a part of it. Yeah.
Representative Saul.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think it was Mr. Miller, you commented that in the case of the peanut butter, that the plant that manufactured that has had some issues in the past. I know you don't have much control over what happens in Georgia, but if we have plants in Minnesota that are constantly having problems, how does the public know about that, and what is the incentive there for them to straighten things out, and are there any penalties for them if they just continually don't?
Mr. Miller?
Madam Chair, Representative, you know, from time to time we do deal with firms that may have a microbial issue in terms of finding on a routine inspection where we find an environmental positive or a positive in a food product that they produce. Depending on where that positive would be found in terms of microbial standpoint, we may ask that the facility cease production for a time in which they can clean, sanitize, work through that process, come back, do some retesting, see if that organism's been eliminated from the environment. We also look at their SOPs, their standard operating procedures, in terms of what they do in terms of cleaning, how they do laboratory, how they do their own sampling, if that's environmental, if they're sampling finished products. So we try to work with firms when we identify problems like that, but the first concern is public health and limiting, you know, any impact to public health. So oftentimes in situations like that, we will have the firm cease production, depending on where the positive might be found. If it's a microbial positive, that may trigger a recall of the product if it's still in the marketplace. So some of it's situationally dependent, but typically when we run into an issue like that, those are the actions that we take with that firm to ensure that the risk to the consumer is mitigated.
Thank you.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just going to help out Representative Szymanski by asking about apple irradiation, but I think I'll forget it.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? Folks, excuse me. Representative Egan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I was just wondering about the interaction with the federal agencies and the USDA and so on, what role they play, not just in finding where the problem is, but in addressing the problem, because as Representative Faust said, you know, the peanut butter case emanated from Georgia. We don't have a lot of control over what's happening there, so we either have to rely on their state. And while we may be doing a good job up here, we can't do anything to address the problems that are occurring down there. So, you know, as far as if other states aren't doing as good a job as the federal government, the USDA, any other federal agencies, are they spending a lot of time addressing these issues? And how do you interact with the federal agencies on this?
Madam Chair, Representative. We work very closely with our district FDA office, so in a scenario like I just described where you may find an environmental positive or a positive in a finished food product, oftentimes we'll actually conduct joint inspections with them, so we'll bring the district FDA inspection staff into that facility, or in some instances it's our activity or our role in that may be where we're brought in because they found a similar situation in a firm that's producing products here in the state. So we tend to work very closely, and when we do that, we sort of split responsibilities. We'll take one side of the investigation and we'll take the other and follow up in that manner. So it tends to be very collaborative when it's in the field. In the case of a traceback investigation, like with the jalapeno peppers, we're constantly providing the FDA district office with information on our traceback, our lab testing, things like that, so that they can then feed that up to the central offices within the federal government to coordinate that, especially when there's a large national outbreak going on. So in the case of salmonella and peppers, salmonella and peanut butter, things like that, we communicate with our district office to share that information with them, as the health communicate with the CDC, so that there's kind of a synergy there, if you will, to communicate and share information as quickly as possible, as quickly as we have it. If our laboratory detects even a preliminary positive in an environmental sample or a finished product, we will share that information as soon as we have it with our federal and state partners.
Are there any other questions? The one question that I would ask is, you know, we have a lot of people out there that don't really know how to plan and prepare a meal. What kind of percentage is that? I know it's out there, but and it's out there pretty big, but do you have any of those kind of numbers?
Madam Chair, are you referring to kind of safe food handling practices within the home?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Actually, this year at the State Fair, we had a whole, our whole booth was at the Department of Agriculture was really devoted to a big piece of that was informing the consumer, the end consumer, what are some of the things and practices that they can, you know, put in place in their own kitchen, so that issues like cross-contamination when you're handling things like raw poultry, you know, using washcloths instead of sponges because the sponges can harbor bacteria and things like that. So that we were out and hopefully reached a lot of citizens of the state in that setting and trying to do some education and outreach, because that is, you know, there's always the potential when you're handling things like chicken and raw poultry, like products like that, where the consumer can actually, you know, further cause an illness if they're not doing proper safe handling practices in the home. Good question.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? Well, thank you. This has been very informational, and you've done a really good job. Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
Oh, the case study?
Madam Chair, we have maybe if we just went through, would you and the members of the committee like to just go through the peanut butter outbreak, perhaps?
I think that's what we would like.
I will jump ahead to that. I invite you and the members of the committee to take a look at some of the handouts that are there in terms of... In terms of some of the trace back diagrams, and that's actually what we use at the department a lot of times, to actually trace the product back as we go through it, so you have those handouts.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I have just a couple of slides that will preface Ben's comments, but this is a kind of the latest map of the number of cases associated with the peanut butter outbreaks by state. You can see that we have 36 cases in Minnesota. And this is what's called an epidemic curve of the outbreak. So it's kind of along the bottom there. You can see our dates, and then the green bars are the number of cases associated with this outbreak. And you can see that the outbreak really got going in October and basically peaked in December. Now, at the top, I hope you can make it out. We did not have cases in Minnesota early on in this outbreak, and we really had very few before the peak. We had our first 9 cases from basically November 4th to December 21st, and they all ate peanut butter of some sort, but there was really nothing that we could firmly put our finger on. In other states, they were talking about maybe chicken is the source. They had a chicken lead, and so we... called on our Department of Agriculture colleagues to kind of trace back the chicken sources of our cases, and that just didn't pan out. And that's great information, too, that said that we need to look for something else. But it was really on December 22nd when a physician called us about a nursing home outbreak in northern Minnesota, and that subsequently some of our other cases had institutional links, other nursing homes, colleges, an elementary school in northern Minnesota, and basically in working with the Department of Agriculture, and we got invoices from these institutions and looked at them, and really the one thing that was standing out, the only thing in common between all these institutions was this King Nut peanut butter. And then we asked the agriculture to go ahead and pick up the this King Nut peanut butter tub, and Leanne has asked the tub that this really was the tub that was the first good evidence that peanut butter was causing this huge nationwide outbreak.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Leanne Johnson. I am the Biological Analysis Section Manager for the Minnesota Department of Agriculture Laboratory Services Division, and that is in fact the smoking tub. This tub was collected by our inspectors from the nursing home where there had been a number of cases. It was submitted to our laboratory. We proceeded to analyze the entire contents of that tub of peanut butter, and we were then the first laboratory in the country to recover the outbreak strain from this implicated food product.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think this outbreak investigation and trace back probably illustrates the collaboration between both departments, as well as the great resources that we have in our MDA laboratory. I will go to the trace back diagram that was provided to you, and you can follow along if you choose to, but as Dr. Smith had mentioned, a number of nursing home facilities in the northwestern part of the state had started to be identified as where there were cases of illness associated with that had the same genetic fingerprints of Salmonella type Miriam. When more cases started to present, and when we overlaid the distribution information, basically who was supplying these facilities with their food, because they were by and large food service facilities, they all had a common supplier, and that was Cisco out of North Dakota. And when we started to link together, as Kirk mentioned, at one point chicken looked like it may be involved, and then when we started to overlay that traceback information with when the cases of illness were starting to become ill, the chicken didn't really fit. And so the more we looked at it, the more peanut butter started to stand out, and that was a collaboration between our inspection staff and myself and some of the epidemiologists at the Minnesota Department of Health. So once we had identified peanut butter as probably a suspect vehicle in this outbreak, we followed that back and tried to link basically the products that Cisco had received and determine who they received that from, and that turns out to be true. This King Nut, which was based in Ohio, they were able to provide a number of lot codes that were associated with the distribution. And so the distribution depended on the timing in which the facility received these shipments. Interestingly enough, if you look at some of those, I think there were three facilities that only received one shipment. So there were illnesses that contaminate King Nut peanut butter. So that starts to stand out as probably a common source. And then you start to look at those lot codes. And what stood out to us, I think, is we started to peel it, peel back the layers in this traceback, was that two lot codes were shared regardless of who received that product when there were cases of illness. So they matched up sort of in a distribution pattern as well as in time. So when the product was received and when the cases started to show up, and these lot codes 275 and 276 those were the common lot codes for us. We actually targeted some of the sampling from product that was still had been distributed and then recalled from those facilities, so we actually sent an inspector to pick those up at the distribution facility, and were able to obtain product from that 276 lot code, as well as quite a few other tubs of peanut butter, as Leanne would attest to in the laboratory. But at 276, we had a 35-pound container that came back positive with the outbreak strain in that container. And then, as I mentioned before, we found another, let's see if I can find that here, another serotype of Salmonella, as well as the Salmonella Tennessee into the Salmonella type of meaning. So there were multiple strains of Salmonella in this product, and that again kind of goes back to, if you look at the reports that the FDA put out on Friday of last week, I think they identified up to four different kinds of Salmonella in that facility. The owners, that facility's own testing had identified over the course of the past year and a half. So there was ample opportunity for contamination, apparently, where that product was manufactured. I will turn it over to Leanne just to cover a little bit about what our laboratory does. It's informative.
Madam Chair, members, I just wanted to walk through kind of what we do in the laboratory to try and coax the Salmonella out of a peanut butter sample. To illustrate some of the challenges that face the food microbiologist, and also to illustrate the collaboration and partnership we have with the Minnesota Department of Health Public Health Laboratory in these types of investigations. One of the challenges facing the food microbiologist is that when food pathogens are present in food, they're usually there in low numbers. They don't, belong there. We don't expect to find them there normally. And when they are there, they tend to be there in low numbers. So it is like looking for the veritable needle in a haystack. Another challenge in trying to coax Salmonella out of a peanut butter sample is that a Salmonella would much rather be inhabiting a human intestinal tract than living in a tub of peanut butter. Pathogens that have gone through food processing are probably stressed or injured, and so they're not in the happiest state of affairs when we get our samples. some of the products that we've tested in association with this outbreak have included numerous peanut butter samples, and then some of the products that have been involved in the recall that contain peanut paste from the company in Lakewood, Georgia. So I'm just going to walk through the steps that we have to go through to finally get an isolate out of the sample. First, we measure out a portion of peanut butter into a broth culture that provides the salmonella with a nice environment favorable for its growth. We incubate it at warm temperatures, give it the kind of conditions it really likes to grow. Unfortunately, if there's any other bacteria in that sample, they'll tend to grow too. So we have to take it to the next step where we do a selective enrichment to try and knock down some of the background bacteria and just promote the growth of the salmonella selectively over the others. Each of these steps is an overnight incubation, so we can't really rush this process. We have to let Mother Nature take its course because we can't make these bacteria really grow any faster than they can. We subject them to another regrowth step to try to increase their numbers to the level where we can detect them with our instrumentation. And then finally subject them, this is where we can get into the CSI kind of stuff, the little more high-tech instrumentation that we have available to us. We'll subject the samples to a screening test that looks for either detecting genetic material that's unique to salmonella or, in this case, antigens that are unique to salmonella. We do the screening test because, as I say, most food samples don't contain foodborne pathogens, so we want to eliminate all of those and not devote any more resources to testing those and to concentrate our efforts on those that test positive at this point. Once we get a positive by our screening test, then we've got to try to isolate the salmonella out of the sample. And this we do by plating onto selective and differential agar media that promotes the growth of salmonella and give us a clue as to their presence. And the little yellow arrow there is pointing to a typical salmonella colony on a plate. At this point, we have to pick many of those individual colonies off the plate, screen those to see if they are, in fact, salmonella. We do that by biochemical screening. And then finally, when everything is looking good there, we'll do, this is not a washer and dryer, that's what someone suggested it look like. This is actually an automated microbial identification system that allows us to run 64 biochemical tests kind of simultaneously and rapidly that, again, help us confirm the identification of the bacteria that we've isolated. Finally, in order to know and confirm that the bacteria that we've isolated is in fact Salmonella typhimurium, the organism we're looking for associated with this outbreak, we have to do serological identification. And only at this point are we able to confirm that we have, in fact, a Salmonella typhimurium isolated from the sample. I think we're running out of time here, so I'll just zip along. Generally, the timeline to complete this analysis is about 6 days, at which point we have an isolate in hand that we can hand off to the health department. Now, here's one of the advantages of being co-located with the health department lab, is literally we are across the hall from each other, so one of our analysts can walk our culture over to a health department analyst for the PFTE, the DNA fingerprinting that would match the food isolate to the outbreak strain. Then, of course, the $64,000 question is, will the food isolate match the outbreak strain? And in this case, these are the actual fingerprints that were obtained from human cases and from the peanut butter isolates that we obtained in our laboratory. And, in fact, the strains do match, and this kind of closes the circle on the outbreak investigation. We're able to confirm that the outbreak strain is in fact the source of, or that the food is in fact the source of the outbreak. We were successful in recovering the outbreak strain from the tub of peanut butter that went around the room. We've also isolated it from another larger container of peanut butter. And as already mentioned, we found some other salmonellas in some other product that we tested. And just to close out my part of the presentation, I think this peanut butter outbreak just offers a really excellent example of how really the four parts of the Department of Health and the Department of Ag work together in having a successful outbreak investigation. And with that, I guess we can take questions. Representative Faust, you've got to go quickly here.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mike, I just want to point something out, you know, through this whole thing. First of all, there were about 45 states that had this outbreak, and we were not the first one. There were several states that had before us, and yet you were the people that found this out of all the states looking for this. You were the one that found it, and so thank you for your good work on this, and congratulations.
Representative Doty.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and first I'd like to echo that, and second, do you have any idea, after you found the smoking tub, how many smoking tubs that were out there from those two lots that were infected would have been consumed?
Madam Chair, Representative, I think there's probably more lots that are contaminated than just those two. That's what we focus on, just based on the distribution information that we had. I think that's difficult to say. You know, there's over 500 cases nationally at this point that have been identified, cases of human illness that have been identified, and you know, rule of thumb is used about you find about 1 in 20 salmonella cases nationally, and the exposure number is probably greater than that. So I think because this has been going on for a long time, and given the level of contamination, there probably were, you know, a significant number of people exposed, and who became ill after that. You know, the health department gets to find out about the ones that were actually detected.
Madam Chair,
Representative Doty.
Thank you. The answer I'm looking for is how many people were saved from eating this peanut butter.
Well, Madam Chair, representatives, it's really, you know, maybe a couple months down the road we'll be able to get their production numbers and estimate that. But just one case in point, at this one nursing home where they had already suffered one fatality, the positive tub of peanut butter still had, what, 3 or 4 pounds out of the 5 left in it and would have been fed to the other residents. And so, you know, I actually think the amount of morbidity and perhaps mortality that we prevented is substantial.
Yeah. And Madam Chair, that nursing home is one that I used to visit in my former career as senior advocate. Thank you for your work.
Thank you very much. And again, you did a great job. Okay.